Welcome back to Gabbing with Gib. I'm your host, Gibson Johns, and today on the show, we're going to do a deep dive into a few of the different lawsuits surrounding the Bravoverse right now. As I mentioned last week, a day or two after the latest round of these legal issues surfaced, I wanted to refrain from getting into them on my own because I don't personally have enough knowledge about the law or what some of these things really mean and entail and signal to make sense of them without an expert in the room. But I also didn't want to ignore them completely because as Bravo fans and viewers and commentators, it's worth unpacking them and understanding what some of the claims being made are and mean for the people that they're about. Even if, like me, you tend to still be siding with the network and Andy and these production companies and Ariana, it is still worth exploring these details and having the discussions. Because even if individually, again, you are like me in that you see a lot of holes and inconsistencies in these lawsuits, taken collectively, it's certainly natural for the fact that there are so many lawsuits popping up right now for that to give you pause. Anyway, today on Gabbing with Gib will be an incredibly informative, helpful, and productive conversation about all of this with Leah Littman, who is a law professor at the University of Michigan, which I am an alum of, as well as the co-host of the super popular podcast about the Supreme Court called Strict Scrutiny. She's also a consumer of all things Bravo, so she really knows what she's talking about here on both the legal side and the Bravo side, which makes her the perfect person to have had on today to talk about all of this. We started off with unpacking Rachel Levis's new lawsuit against Tom Sandoval and Ariana Madix before moving on to Leah McSweeney's against Bravo, the production companies and Andy Cohen, and then touched upon Brandy Glanville's against Bravo and Andy Cohen before discussing them overall, why having some conflicting feelings as a viewer amid all of this news could be natural, how it maybe all ties back to Bethany Frankel's so-called reality reckoning, and much more. Keep listening for my conversation with Leah Littman. Check out her podcast, Strict Scrutiny, wherever you get your podcasts. And please take a second to make sure you're subscribed to Gabbing with Gib wherever you're listening to this right now. Throw us a 5-star rating or be even more generous by leaving us a positive review. Thanks for listening. I want to gab.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, today we're gabbing with Leah Littman, who is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School, as well as one of the co-hosts of the popular Crooked Media podcast, Strict Scrutiny, which provides in-depth, accessible, and irreverent analysis of the Supreme Court and its cases, culture, and personalities. We have Leah on the podcast today to help us break down and better understand the recently filed lawsuits surrounding the Bravoverse. Leah, thank you for being here. How's it going?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Actually, this morning, a Facebook memory popped up and it showed me the day I ran into Heather Dubrow randomly at a yoga studio. So wow. I feel like this is a sign.
That was a sign, as well as the fact that, again, I told you this right before we started recording, but we have a University of Michigan connection. I am an alum of University of Michigan and you teach there. So
I'm also an alum of
the
law
school. Yeah, you're also an alum, so. Right.
Go blue.
Go blue. So I guess before we get into everything, can you give listeners just a quick TLDR of anything else they should know about your background as well as your relationship and knowledge of Bravo in general?
Sure. So I'm a law professor, but in my free time, I am a Bravo aficionado. when I used to live in Southern California, I used to teach at University of California, Irvine. We would purposefully make trips into LA so I could go to Pump and Sir and all of those places because that's just my world. You know, on the podcast where we cover the Supreme Court, ever since Heather Gay said it, right, a recurring line is receipts, timeline, screenshot, et cetera. And so, that's also very much a part of my world. I've been a Bravo fan for as long as I can remember. And, we try to incorporate some of the Bravo universe into our commentary about the court.
I love that. That your mind is probably just merging into one place for this podcast. And it's
exactly. This is like my ideal crossover. Law, Bravo. This is where I was meant to be.
Right. And I really operate from the Bravo lens. And like, obviously, when these things pop up, it's one of those things where like, it feels tough to talk about if you don't have the tools to talk about these things. They're very, you know, we love our Bravo for the drama and some of the more petty stuff. But when it gets to like the more serious stuff, sometimes I bite my tongue because I'm like, well, I don't really know what I'm talking about when it comes to what's actually going on, you know? And so I'm really happy to have you on to help us kind of parse through some of this stuff.
Yeah, happy to talk about it. As it turns out, like some of the drama and pettiness like within the Bravoverse like could end up being potentially relevant to at least some of the legal claims in some of the lawsuits.
As I was sort of refamiliarizing myself with some of the lawsuit, it almost feels like there's all this like superfluous information that's included. But so and we'll get into it. But part of my some of my questions are like, is that even relevant to some of their claims? So, okay, so let's first dive into a lawsuit that was filed last week. It is Rachel Levis. She filed a lawsuit against Tom Sandoval and Ariana Madix. Obviously, I'm coming from the pop culture lens, so I kind of read like the page six rundown of it or like the deadline rundown of it. But it that tells us that she is suing them for revenge porn, eavesdropping, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and invasion of privacy. This is all pertaining to an intimate FaceTime between her and Sandoval, which he allegedly recorded without her consent. It's the video that Ariana saw in his phone, which tipped her off to the fact that they were even having an affair in the first place. Rachel says that, you know, Ariana sent it to her, you know, that night. And that's how Rachel even found out that the recordings existed. So it's kind of a layered situation. So when you first saw this, when you first read sort of the rundown of a lawsuit, what went through your mind? What were your kind of your biggest takeaways?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as a law professor and as a lawyer, you know, when I read a complaint, what I'm really looking for is whether someone has basically said enough in the complaint to what we call in the legal business, like state the elements of their claim. So all of the claims that you just rattled off, like revenge porn, intentional infliction of emotional distress, in order to successfully sue someone, you need to make out certain elements. So for revenge porn, for example, you have to show that someone distributed an image with the purpose of intentionally causing, you know, emotional distress. And so when I read the complaint, I was asking, has Rachel said enough in the complaint to make the court think she could actually prove the elements of her claim? Because that's what the next stage of the case is. You read the complaint, you assume everything that the plaintiff says is true, and you ask, like, if what they say is true, like, would they win? Would they have a legal claim? All of the next stages will be about, have you actually, you know, proven this, right? You'll collect evidence, you'll hear testimony and whatnot. But the first stage is just like, have you said enough to actually potentially be allowed to prove your case? And that is, I think, a little bit unclear, at least with respect to the claims against Ariana.
Ariana is basically included in here because, I mean, from my understanding, Rachel's accusing her of sending the video around.
Yeah. So this is part of the odd aspect of this complaint. Let's bracket the claim against Tom Sandoval for eavesdropping, which is, you know, he recorded her without her consent. That, you know, as stated, is a violation of California law because California law requires the consent of both parties, you know, in order for the video to be recorded. But the claims against Ariana, you know, as I was saying, in order to, you know, again, sue her, she'd have to show that Ariana distributed the image with the purpose of causing emotional distress. And it's not totally clear that the complaint says Ariana distributed the image because a lot of the complaint talks about how, well, Ariana described the video to other people, but that's not distributing the image. Then there's a question of, well, does she say she distributed the image? She basically says, I think she did, because other people were talking about the video, but I was talking about the video. Lots of people were talking about the video.
Right.
We never saw the video.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so like merely saying other people were talking about the video doesn't establish that Ariana distributed the image.
Right. I guess a follow-up question is one of the things that she has said is that Ariana sent it to her.
Exactly.
And I guess from your expert perspective, is that enough to prove that Ariana, quote, distributed these videos, I guess, with the, again, intent to cause emotional distress?
Yeah. So again, I think that's a little unclear from the complaint. One is there's going to be a legal question about whether distributing an image includes sending the image to the person in the video, right? And so I can imagine a court saying it could be, right? Like imagine, for example, if Tom took a screenshot from the video, sent it to Rachel and said, unless you pay me $1 million, right, I'm going to share this, right? Like that seems like it's distributing an image in order to cause emotional distress.
Right.
But that second part, it's not clear that Ariana did that as alleged in the complaint, because it sounds like from the complaint, she sent a screenshot or an image and said, right, I know about this, right? Like, we're no longer friends. You messed up. So that, I just don't know whether a court would say that is intentionally causing emotional distress. And one reason I say that is because revenge porn laws are extremely important legal advances, right, to protect intimate privacy.
Yes.
But part of the obstacle to passing them was there were concerns about whether they were constitutional under the First Amendment, because the First Amendment, right, protects the ability to share images, speak, and whatnot. And so if you're applying this law to prevent someone from expressing, I know what you did and you hurt me, without making like any kind of threat, right, then I think it's a little bit dicey. And so I just don't know whether a court would say, yeah, Ariana sending an image to Rachel saying, I know what you did, violates the revenge porn law.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. Let's circle back to the eavesdropping claim against Sandoval, because that, again, from my understanding, is, you know, him recording without her consent.
Yep.
Again, I guess you have to kind of make the conclusion that she did not know that he was recording it. And
yes.
But
yep.
And I guess all signs, again, she has to prove this, but all signs do point to the videos existing, right?
Yes.
And
yep.
So what is your takeaway from that claim, and how she can go about, I guess, proving that?
Yeah. So I think she's done enough in the complaint to be given an opportunity to prove her case, right? She says in the complaint, I did not, right, know this was recorded. And so again, at this stage, at this first stage, it's just going to be, if what you say is true, do you have a claim? And then the next stage is going to be, can you prove that claim? And so at the next stage, right, you'll probably have like a deposition where Sandoval's lawyer interviews her. Maybe Sandoval will be deposed as well. And if they say conflicting things, right, then a court will have to resolve the evidence and ask, right, is there really a genuine dispute about whether she knew the video was recorded? And so basically, like at every stage of the case, there will be a different level of proof that she is held to.
Got it. And then there's these other sort of like big statements that are made within this complaint. Like, you know, one is that lost in the mix was Levis was a victim of the predatory and dishonest behavior of an older man. You know, it was distributed and discussed publicly by a scorned woman seeking vengeance, catalyzing the scandal. And then another point says, you know, the rest of the cast enjoyed unseen levels of public recognition and professional opportunity off the back of this scandal. But, you know, she was humiliated and villainized for public consumption, remains a shell of her former self. Does all of that information matter? Does the size of what happened after, in terms of the scandal, does that matter? Does the fact that other people profited off of this matter? Are they saying that Rachel couldn't profit off it because the video existed?
I mean, it's a little bit unclear. You know, there are portions of the complaint that seem to suggest Rachel wants to say Ariana knew about the affair earlier.
Mm.
I don't know why exactly that is relevant, but right, part of this just has to be an effort at reclaiming her own public narrative.
For sure.
And, you know, that's part of what lawsuits are designed to do, right? They present your side of the story. They are reported in the media. And, right, that is part of the litigation game. But I do think another part of it is, it is designed to help the reader hear the judge, right, ask, do I think it is plausible and that Rachel can prove, you know, that these people basically mistreated her? And of course, right, if you paint them out to be, right, bullies who took advantage of someone, then, you know, maybe, right, he or she or they will be inclined to kind of fill in the gaps in the complaint and say, maybe if given the chance, like Rachel could prove her claim.
Last big question about this lawsuit is, it's a civil complaint, correct? So can you explain exactly what that means and maybe what it tells us about what she's looking for and how that would differentiate it from like a criminal complaint or a criminal case?
Yep. A civil claim is just, you know, one party suing another, usually for money. So the classic remedy in a civil case is damages rather than in a criminal case, it's a possibility that someone goes to jail. So the fact that it's a civil case means it's just one private party against another, you know, suing largely for money.
Mm-hmm. And there was some report in the Daily Mail, again, who knows if it actually came from his camp, but it was like Sandoval basically just wants to throw a bunch of money at this to make it go away. Is that what tends to happen in cases like this?
Yes. Honestly, like most cases are usually resolved through settlement. They won't actually go to trial or they'll be resolved at kind of earlier stages in litigation. So, for example, it's possible that some or all of the claims against Ariana end up being dismissed, mm-hmm. which means, you know, no one's going to get anything. The case is over, you know, but another possibility is, you know, someone who sued makes an offer to the person who sued them and says, you know, if I give you this amount of money, will you dismiss your own case?
Got it. Okay. So I think that kind of covers a lot of this first one. 2 days before Rachel filed her lawsuit, it came out that Leah McSweeney, who had been on The Real Housewives of New York, as well as Real Housewives Ultimate Girls Trip, she was suing Bravo and Andy Cohen for basically, again, in the words of a lot of the coverage, intentionally preying on her alcohol problems, essentially for ratings. She claims the network breached her rights by failing to allow her to seek proper care for her alcohol addiction, even though executives are aware of the problem and she is seeking unspecified damages. Again, what were your first sort of big takeaways when you read about this lawsuit and this complaint?
Yeah, so this complaint, frankly, was better put together than Rachel's complaint against Tom and Ariana. It included more specific information in the complaint, you know, and that makes it easier, again, to kind of get past the initial stage of a case and be allowed to prove your case. That being said, I think raising these kinds of discrimination claims, so in addition to the disability discrimination claims, there are also claims of hostile work environment, both on the basis of like sex and disability, as well as a religious discrimination claim for the failure to, you know, offer food options that weren't cooked in pork products. A lot of these claims, I think, implicate employment law, but in a really unusual context. And this is kind of what we were talking about at the top of the show, which is Bravo, you know, and The Real Housewives is designed to be filled with drama, right? Like mm-hmm. people watch it because it is over the top people, right, who sometimes get more than a little inebriated and do wild and crazy things. And so in that context, applying something like the Americans with Disabilities Act to ask for an accommodation, you know, for someone with a substance abuse problem is just going to be a lot trickier than applying it in a more standard work environment where, you know, again, the employer isn't intentionally selecting people based on whether they are going to make for good TV. And again, you know, creating an environment that is designed to produce drama.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like, again, as from a non-expert point of view, one of my biggest first takeaways from reading kind of the initial coverage of Leah's lawsuit was like, there were a lot of claims being made and a lot of them kind of don't, I guess they all ladder up into one kind of overarching thing, but like a lot of them don't really have to do with one another. And I'm curious, does that bolster her case because there are so many claims or can it be almost too much noise and not focused enough?
It's tough. I think they included as many things as possible in order to give readers a sense for how the Bravo universe works. And mm-hmm. in particular, you know, some aspects of her claims are designed to convey the impression that she did not feel like she was in a position to say no. And so in order to establish that, it almost felt like she and her lawyers felt the need to just provide as much information about the Bravo universe, including like Below Deck, right? And other shows of which like she is not a part, you know, in order to kind of say, this is how the world works. And so it felt like to me, some of them were included in order to give more context to maybe the more like focal points of her case.
Got it. And, you know, one of the things that I found interesting is that, you know, I feel like in the lead up to her joining Real Housewives of New York, she kind of gave in press interviews and I think even on the show, like she gave this kind of like timeline of when she, you know, she had been sober for a while, but then she decided to start drinking, you know, 6 months before filming started.
Yes.
And in that time, you know, obviously there is casting that happens, there are producer conversations that happen that we are not privy to, but
yep.
I kind of felt like, as a reader of this information, that the timeline had sort of shifted, because she sort of, one of the claims that she basically says that, like, producers were pushing her to drink and she wasn't given much of an opportunity to say no to drinking, when she had said previously in years past that, like, she had decided to drink before joining the show. So what does that impact anything? Like what she said in the press, for example?
Yeah. So it absolutely will, though probably at a later stage of the case, because the first step of the case is assume everything, right, she says in the complaint is true. Has she, like, won an opportunity to basically prove that what she said is true, right? And actually make out her complaint. But absolutely, at the next stage, right, if she gets past a motion to dismiss, Bravo is going to come back with, you said very different things about your timeline. And then, right, there's going to be a question about, well, like, if there's conflicting evidence, could a jury still, you know, find for Leah and conclude, like, her evidence is basically more persuasive than Bravo's? And if they conclude it is, then it would go to a jury and a jury would decide, like, who's more believable.
Got it. And then the other thing that kind of jumps out to, I think, most people reading this, and I've seen a lot of comments about this online, is, like, a lot of these claims, you know, I guess they would make a lot more sense if she never came back to the show, but she came back to Real Housewives of New York for another season and then also decided to join Real Housewives Ultimate Girls Trip like a year later. Does that impact anything? Or I'm guessing it would maybe come later to sort of disprove,
you know,
some of her stuff.
Exactly. I can imagine it coming up later, where Bravo says, you know, it doesn't seem like you didn't like this environment because you came back. I have to say, like, I have some doubts about, right, some of these legal claims, maybe many of these legal claims. But I think the idea that someone goes back to a not great work environment is not necessarily, like, the most persuasive evidence against their case, right? Because, like, walking away from a job opportunity, even if it's a really, you know, horrible one, is tough for people to do.
Fair. Yeah. Yeah. Fair. It's like, it's, you have to think from her mindset of, like, okay, I'm losing this paycheck, or I'm losing this source of income.
Yep.
A superfluous claim, in my opinion, that got a lot of coverage, it's gotten a lot of pushback, is her claim about Andy Cohen, who,
yes,
you know, she claims that he essentially does drugs and offered it to her, and she got punished when she said no to that offer through a bad edit.
Yeah.
A lot of housewives have come out in support of him and said that they've never been offered anything by him. How do you unpack something like that? Because that to me read as, like, I want to make a headline out of this and,
yes,
and get more coverage of my complaint.
I think that's right. And I think they were proved correct because, right, that got a ton of headlines and coverage after that. But I think, you know, that aspect of the complaint felt a little bit to me, maybe like switching Bravo show references, kind of like Tom Schwartz's, like, there's a man eating crocodile in the Nile, like, attempt to kind of like pull attention away from, like, other things,
yeah,
in the complaint, because, you know, you're right that, like, just saying, I said no to the offer and therefore got a bad edit, like, in order to actually prove that, you know, you need to show that the edit you got is, like, causally related to your refusal to say no. That is going to turn on, like, who among everyone is involved in all of these editing decisions and what the other options are. And that's going to be a pretty
tough
claim, exactly, to make out. But again, at this stage where you just assume, right, that what you say is true, is that enough? The one thing I would say about that is, even at this, like, early stage of the litigation,
yeah,
you're still expected to provide some evidence to substantiate your claim. And, like, what she's claimed here is a conclusion, right, a legal conclusion. I was retaliated against because I said no. But it's not clear, like, what her evidence is to support, mm-hmm, that at this stage. And so there's some possibility that this claim kind of goes away early, but it's,
yeah,
just hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard to say. And then I guess I have a just general question about the inclusion of Andy in her, yeah, and some of these, is because it's there are a lot of claims here, and he's kind of directly involved in some of the complaints, but in some of them, it feels like he's sort of just included because he's an executive producer of the show. And again,
yeah,
attaching his name, directly calling him out, gets the press, gets the coverage, you know, because it's hard to imagine. I mean, I know that he does give notes on episodes and things like that, and, like, makes and how is involved in casting decisions and things like that. I think we can all glean that from past comments that he's made. But is the inclusion of him and calling him out directly, again, is it the same as like the drug reference of just like, let's make a big splash?
I think that had to be part of it, in part because for some of the legal claims, it's not actually clear you can sue individual employers rather than the employer as such, right? So like you can sue the company, but you might not be able to sue like your supervisor who also works at the company. So, you know, it's just...
Okay. So Rachel has the same lawyer as Brandy Glanville, who is also... She filed a lawsuit as well, claiming that Andy Cohen, or accusing Andy Cohen of sexual harassment via this like suggestive FaceTime that he did with Kate Chastain, allegedly. And there, again, there's a lot more details there. But again, it's just another thing that sort of calls out Andy directly. Yeah. And we're, and I think with Brandy, it's, it should be said that there's a lot of like, there's a lot of more history, I think, involved in what informed some of this. Again, give me the sort of top line takeaways from you when this happened.
Yeah. So I think one thing that might be important for listeners to understand is how shitty employment law is to employees. So proving that you were subject to a hostile work environment, right, because of sexual harassment or sex discrimination is really tough. You usually have to show it's severe and pervasive. Right. And there are all of these legal rules. One I'll just note here called the stray remarks doctrine, which basically say if all your employer did is to make like a single offhand comment, that's just not enough for a hostile workplace claim. And so again, like even if everything, right, alleged in this complaint is true, and there is no additional context that changes possibly the social meaning of the different interactions, I don't know, again, given how difficult employment law is for employees, right, to sue their employers for these hostile work environment claims, whether there's enough, again, based on that incident to make out a claim. And again, like I'm one of those people that thinks employment law like should be more attuned,
of course,
right, and more favorable to employees. But
of course, it's
tough.
Not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just not. Right. And you know, I think the some of the added context around the latest Brandy claim is that, you know, she had been accused herself of sexual impropriety by Caroline Manzo during this kind of really, there's a lot of noise around this one season of Ultimate Girls Trip, essentially. And Caroline Manzo has a lawsuit of her own. She, I think her claims tie into Leah's claims of like flying the Real Housewives with alcohol, causing them to be intoxicated and having them do things that they wouldn't have otherwise done. It's kind of all really messy, and I think it's all kind of connected and involved. Does that hurt their cases that it's just like noisy, or is it really kind of separated out in these individual cases?
I think it's pretty separated out, you know, in part because, you know, Leah is suing people who Caroline Manzo is not suing, you know,
right.
And so these cases are going to be assigned potentially to different judges. And while you and I are all in the Bravoverse, it's not clear that your average judge is reading all of Page Six and like aware of everything that is going on in the Bravoverse. And so I don't know how much of that context like will inform the other cases. I'm sure there will be references to them, but like each case will fall on its own bottom.
Mm-hmm. Does Brandy's claim have legs, do you think, in terms of, I mean, there's obviously a lot of gray area when it comes to Andy and his role in terms of he's talent, he's executive producer, he's involved in decisions, but he also has this chummy relationship with a lot of the talent. And if, is that good or bad? I think that's kind of up to interpretation in some, in a lot of ways. And then it's also like Brandy herself has been known to, you know, act a certain way for good TV, or, and I mean, there has been over a decade of her being on TV and kind of pushing the boundary and towing the line. And is that stuff that like Bravo or Andy would bring into the...
Absolutely. Yeah. That's going to come in at a later stage of the case. And I think this is partially getting at the thing we've kind of alluded to, which is, you know, for all of these claims, part of Bravo's defense is going to be, we don't operate like a normal employer.
Right.
We are selecting people based on their proclivity for drama. And we, right, invite people, right, into situations that they know, right, are designed to facilitate drama. And so if I can just like say a little bit about how kind of like an ADA claim would work, like in
Do
the
it.
Normal course. So let's take like Leah McSweeney's claim, for example, against Bravo under the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, substance abuse disorders, right, are entitled to reasonable accommodations, you know, under the ADA. But employers can come back with a defense that says, we can't actually offer you an accommodation here because we have a policy of, let's say, right, filling positions based on seniority or filling positions with like the best qualified applicant. And you can't force us, right, to basically violate that policy. And so if Bravo comes back with our policy is selecting, right, the most drama-filled, unhinged individuals in order to create great TV and put them into environments that are, you know, just kind of like waiting to burn. It's not exactly clear what a reasonable accommodation looks like in that situation. And so that's part of why this lawsuit is, you know, both kind of legally interesting, but also, you know, just might not end up going anywhere.
Totally. And it's also, you know, we've heard publicly from other Bravo talent who are sober, who have said, I've never felt pressure to drink.
Yep.
I have never been plied with alcohol. I have been provided water, another non-alcoholic beverage in lieu of alcohol. And I'm guessing that comes in later in the process and things like that.
Exactly. I mean, like Lala Kent's, right, like big storyline for several seasons has been like her journey towards sobriety. And so Bravo can absolutely introduce that and say, look, we're willing to work with people, but, right, you kind of need to make the ask, right? And you need to know like the situation and circumstances, you know, in which you are asking to be employed.
Yeah. I guess just from your general perspective, I think another question is sort of like, what responsibility does the individual who is making the complaint have to recognize that like, okay, maybe this just like isn't a good environment for me to be in? And I guess it gets it back into like, you know, you can't blame them for wanting to get a paycheck and for wanting to continue their employment. But it's kind of that push and pull of like recognizing when it's a good time for you to step away and to pull yourself out of that situation.
Yeah, you know, it is a tricky balance. And I would think that most people, you know, who join the Bravo universe after there have been a few seasons and a few series of Real Housewives know the general gist.
Sure.
They kind of know what they're signing up for. And so I think it's fair to say, well, look, if you're opting into a work environment that you know, again, is like fueled with drama and there will be a lot of people drinking around you, that is, right, the work environment. And so if Bravo isn't saying, like, you need to drink in order to be on this show, then, again, it's just,
yeah,
I think that they Bravo, right, can come back with, look, this is kind of our employment policy. People know what they're signing up for.
Right. And, like, from my perspective, you know, it's like individually in a lot of these cases, I kind of, and it's hard to parse through like, okay, am I sort of siding with the network or Andy just because of like allegiance or like longtime viewership or not wanting to be changed or whatever. But like individually, I kind of feel like there are holes in a lot of these cases, but collectively it's sort of like there are a lot of cases happening right now.
Yes.
And it points to maybe there is something that needs to be changed or just tweaked or, you know, put in place to prevent any kind of rooted in truth, whatever. How do you think about that when you think about that collectively? Like there must be something that should be changed here.
Yeah. And so just to take one thing that you mentioned, which is the fact that Andy Cohen is both kind of talent, but also in leadership and involved in kind of producing the show and maintains a kind of friendly relationship, right, and a social relationship with many of the people in the universe. I think a lot of people like the idea of being friends with their boss, right, and having a chummy work environment. But the reality is work is not your family. And if you have a work environment where there's like an expectation, right, of, well, some people around me are like really close to the boss, I think that is not unreasonable to think that is potentially ripe for abuse. Again, if only because people feel like, well, if I'm not as close to the boss, am I going to get the same opportunities? And that might create some pressure, you know, in order to do things that you think will get you close to the boss and so on and so forth. And so I think that environment, right, is absolutely like rife for abuse and might be something that Bravo thinks like, okay, like given the kind of nuanced role that like and multifaceted role that Andy has, maybe it's worth rethinking just the norms that we want to set for relationships between, you know, talent, producers, casts, and so on. But it is, again, it's going to be tricky. You know, we've seen people on other reality television shows say, I got really close to producers, right? Because like they're around all the time. I'm talking to them about feelings. Like we talk about beginning filming and like what I'm okay with. And so some of that is going to be inevitable. But I think, again, based on everything we've seen, there's a good chance that Bravo, again, you know, may have gone a little bit too far in blurring the lines between work, social, personal.
It's a hard thing to unfurl because it's like, how do you, you know, even if you were like, okay, to communicate with Anne, do you have to go through like an official email or something like that? But it's like, how do you tell Kyle Richards, who has been on the show for 13 seasons and they are genuinely friends, how do you tell us, how do you tell her you can't text him? You know what I mean? That's a tough thing.
Exactly. And also, like, this isn't a traditional work environment, right? Yeah. They're not going to a job 9 to 5, right? They're out, like, late, right? And, like, being filmed, you know, when they, like, wake up. And so, of course, right, that is itself going to blur some of the boundaries. But it's a tough situation.
Definitely. Yeah. And then with the producer thing you said, it's like, these field producers, like, that's how they get stuff out of the talent and get them to open up, is to cultivate those relationships with them. Yep. So It's like you said, it's very tough. And I'm just so curious how you can even put a boundary in there at this at this sort of late stage of the game. There has to be something they can do. But I just don't, again, I'm not the expert here, but I mean,
honestly, like one very easy thing I think they could do is just clarify Andy Cohen's role in cutting tape, right? Like if they say,
totally,
Andy, right, doesn't have final decision or, right, isn't going to have a hand in cutting the final tape, right? Like, I think that would eliminate a lot of the pressure, right, that anyone might feel to, like, cultivate a good or, right, avoid a bad relationship with Andy.
Totally. And then the other sort of element of thinking about all this collectively and holistically is it's following Bethany Frankel's reality reckoning and that whole effort to unionize reality stars and to, you know, force these networks, not just Bravo, you know, networks in general to enact better practices and to have, you know, more guardrails and safety measures, all these things, which actually NBC and Bravo have done. Like they, I think they sort of immediately announced that sort of after that Vanity Fair article, I want to say, you know, and I said, you know, Brandy and Rachel have the same lawyer and some of it sort of the timing of it all feels really, I don't want to say coordinated, but it's interesting that this is all happening around the same time. Does it ladder all up into the same thing? Is it, do you feel like there's a coordination happening? Does that help their cases that there's a, that they could all be doing at the same time? I don't know. It just gets the wheels turning, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there's some coordination happening at the level of, you know, oh, right, I know this other lawsuit, right, is potentially in the works. That might change the public narrative, right, about Bravo or Andy Cohen, right? And make, we just had a conversation about all of the complaints holistically. And so if it was just one complaint, right, it might look different and it might feel different, right, than if it's several, right, along with other reporting. So I'm sure, right, it is going to affect the calculus of both individual people weighing whether to sue, as well as lawyers and when to bring the case and how to style the case, that there are these other conversations happening, both in other lawsuits, as well as just in the Bravo commentary world about how Bravo is working.
Right. When the reality reckoning conversation was first happening, and there weren't really lawsuits involved in that, it was just sort of like, okay, how do we sort of write some of this shit? Were there any other like outlying thoughts or reactions that you had from a legal perspective that jumped out at you when that first started kind of rolling?
Yeah, I think in some ways starting with the Housewives was almost a disservice to the movement because, you know, the Housewives, they are not exactly the kind of people who are entirely dependent, right, on the Bravo paycheck in order to live the lives they are living. Whereas people on other reality shows, some on Bravo, right, and some on other networks are more dependent on those Bravo paychecks. And so I think in some ways, like starting on the Housewives and focusing on that was not necessarily the best from a strategic perspective in order to highlight some of the more problematic aspects of, you know, being on reality TV.
And then lastly, I alluded to this a couple questions ago, but like it does, hearing all this, seeing all this happening, and again, kind of in sequential action almost, it's sort of, it gets you thinking as a viewer, like, you know, is it moral, or is it like, am I watching something that's sort of like icky? I don't feel that way, but it definitely, like, I'm sure some people do feel that way. Have you ever had that thought? Like, again, since some of these things have kind of bubbled to the surface.
Yeah. So my own personal view is I'm totally fine watching reality TV that is full of adults who make a conscious yes. decision about whether to enter the reality television world that, again, they knew what it was like when they signed up for it, right? And they knew it had an upside, and they also knew the downsides. And so that, to me, is very different than watching television shows that focus on, like, children and, like, beauty pageants. Like, that I can't watch because it Absolutely. Does feel kind of weird and abusive to me.
Yeah.
Exactly. But this, I think, you know, we're adults. Like, some of these people are lawyers. And so it's like, okay, you know, I kind of think, again, you knew what you were signing up for. And there's also so much out there that many of them cultivate, right? Kind of, again, like storylines or opportunities to act in, like, really outlandish ways in order to increase their profile. So, you know, I don't personally feel a lot of qualms watching this, again, because people knew what they were signing up for. And, you know, I'm not going to sign up for a Real Housewives series.
Because
like, I know my limitations. As much as I love Bravo and maybe would love to be a friend occasionally, Ariana, call me. Again, like, it's just, you know, kind of what you're doing. And when you're older than, like, 22, right? Come on.
You can't kind of feign ignorance a little bit about it. Yeah,
yeah.
Totally. Well, Leah, this has been so informative and helpful and just not, I don't want to say fun to unpack it, but I've really enjoyed talking to you. You are one of the co-hosts of Strict Scrutiny. Can you tell people when and where to listen to that? Because it really is such a great and, again, informative show.
Yeah. So our episodes drop every Monday. We'll also have emergency bonus episodes whenever there is a particularly outlandish decision by the court or some reporting. So we just did a decision about the disqualification case involving the presidency. But that's where you can find our podcast. And you will even hear some occasional Bravo references on the podcast, not just the Heather Kay, but also Scandoval. I once attempted to draw, like, an extended analogy between Scandoval and the Supreme Court, where, like, Tom Sandoval was, like, Sam Alito and the Supreme Court. Ariana was America/democracy. And Raquel/Rachel was Donald Trump. And it worked in my mind. And I was trying to convey something. And anyway, so we have a good
listen, we tried it. We tried it. Leah, thank you so much for taking the time for doing this. And again, I think a lot of people will find this really, really helpful. So thanks again and have a great rest of your week.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the show. Subscribe to Gabbing with Gib on any podcast platform to listen to new episodes, and subscribe to Gabbing with Gib on YouTube to watch full-length versions of our interviews. We'd also love your support with a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. You can follow me at Gib Sonoma on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, and keep up with all things Gabbing with Gib at Gabbing with Gib on Instagram and TikTok. Gabbing with Gib is an independent podcast hosted by me, Gibson Johns. It's produced by myself and Riley Dabbs. Graphics are by Rachel Roth, and our cover art photography is by Troy Hallahan. If you want to reach out about guest booking, sponsorship, or advertising opportunities, email us at gabbingwithgib@gmail.com. Thank you again for your support, and see you next time.